Well, it's that after lunch class now, where your lunch settles in. It's not your fault. It's just part of the biology. You get in there, and blood starts going to your stomach instead of your brain, and you just start getting sleepy, and you want to go to sleep. But I'll warn you, if you do go to sleep, you're going to be the first one out there to play football in that flop mess out there right now. So we'll put you out there and put you on the first string team. we'll take girls. That's okay. Anyways, well, hopefully after lunch you can still stay with it. One more class. I should find out, though, do we quit? When do we quit? I got to get a schedule at some point. Maybe 2:30? 2:30. Thank you. All right. That's good. All right. Can't serve God and mammon. Now, you might wonder, like, why do we really pick that in the midst of all this stuff on learning as a member of God's family? But you know, that shows up, you know, in those chapters where Jesus is talking about raising your level of living to God's family. And serving God and mammon is one of the things he picks up on, because he realizes that this is a common problem amongst human people. This is one of those areas that we have to work on in life, because by nature, we would love to serve mammon. And so what the angels have to do is work on this all the time to convince us that, no, this isn't worth serving. This really isn't going to bring you happiness. Maybe for the moment you think it's going to bring you a lot of fun, but if you read Ecclesiastes and you didn't learn the lesson, they have to reteach it to you. Because Solomon went through it for all of us. God took like the greatest case of somebody who had all the power, all the wealth, everything you can imagine, gave him everything, and he ran the test, and he comes out of it and says, wow, what a waste that was. It was all vanity, if you believe him. And in the end, he concludes that really you ought to just remember your Creator in the days of your youth, because before those evil days come. See, and most of us, we know the stories. You read through Ecclesiastes, you've read it before. You realize that he tells you that, you know, even if you do go make all kinds of stuff and you get all these possessions that you think are so important for you, they only last a few years, and next thing you know, you die. And who gets them? Somebody gets them that maybe doesn't even care about them, never worked for them, and you just pass them on, and you're gone. You're not even there. And what have you gained from all of that? Or better yet, you're one of those people that care so much about serving the God of the mammon of power and wealth. You love it when people look at you and you can't wait to have like some kind of like position of authority where you can have all this stuff, and you want some fame, and you become really, really popular for a while. And Solomon points out, yeah, but how long does that last? Next thing you know, everybody forgot about you and they're on to somebody else. I mean, all those things are in Ecclesiastes, if you read it carefully. He covers all those cases of the things that would drive us to serve mammon. And he says, I tried them all. And if you can believe me, they really don't bring happiness. They're so short-lived. And so that's the kind of thing we want to look at in this third, in this class this afternoon. So in Matthew 6, that's our reading for Sunday. Matthew 6, you know, a lot of these ideas came from, really, is that Jesus points out you cannot serve two masters. You have to make a choice. You can't do both. We try to do that sometimes. We play the game of serving both, but you really can't do it. For either you will hate the one and love the other, or else you will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Isn't that what happens, though, with people? Is that sometimes we try to serve mammon for a while, and what happens is, because of all of the stuff in the truth, our Bible things, they get into our mind, and we know it's wrong, and you start to despise the fact that, why did I ever get taught this? Why did mom and dad ever teach me these things? It's like, you almost wish sometimes, like, you didn't even know that, so you could just go have your fun. Even though Solomon said it's a waste, because it's so short-lived. But you do have to make a choice. You really can't have it both ways, and I think what happens with a lot of us when we're young is we think we can have it both ways. And it takes the experience of life to try to teach us that it really doesn't work. If you're wondering what in the world mammon was, and you try to go back and figure out, I must be standing too close to the speaker. Mammon, they think it may have originated from this Aramaic word up there, an Aramaic word that's connected with the idea of mammon. But it seems to have something to do with riches or money. And people think that it might even be connected with a Hebrew word that has a meaning of that which is to be trusted. So that what Jesus is getting at is that you can't serve a God that wants you to trust that stuff and also serve the Lord our God. You really can't have it both ways. You trust one or you trust the other, but you can't trust both. So you start looking at, well, what is mammon today? What have we got out there? And for some of us, you know, it's different for each person. There really isn't just one mammon. It all depends on your personality and your interests in life. For some of you guys, maybe it's that car. You just can't wait to have that fast, good-looking car. You know, some of my boys were like that. And I'd look at them like, what do you care about? Why do you care so much about a car? You know, I was just glad to have a Volkswagen that actually worked and was really cheap on gas, and that's how I grew up. But they loved those cars, those fancy cars and fast cars. Some of you guys, maybe it's the bodies, you know, guys or girls. You want to look really cute if you're the girls, and the guys want to be all buffed up. All right, so we got a few girls today that you want to be buffed up, but usually it's the guys that are into that. Or maybe it's money over there on the side that for some of you, you serve the god of money. You just can't wait to have lots of money so you can have all these things that are going to bring you happiness. You can't wait for that big home with the swimming pool and you know, all that stuff there. You just, that's your dream world. Like, oh, that's really going to make me happy. I mean, this is exactly what Solomon thought. He tried all these different things and thought they were going to bring him happiness, only to find out in the end that they're really just a bunch of vanity. Or for some of us, you can't wait to be up on that platform and have, you know, have that popularity and fame. That may be your thing in life. Whatever it is, everybody has something that they want. For some of you, you're still wishing for that little smartphone over there. When are mom and dad going to get me one of those, right? Yeah, so that's okay. You start out with small things and work your way up. But that's the way life is. But you can't have it both ways. So I thought it'd be good to look at least the case of Naaman. And you go back and look at Bible characters with Naaman and Gehazi and what was actually going on at that time. So you know the story. This is one of your Sunday school stories. You know that what happened with Naaman is that, you know, Elisha told him that all you got to do is go get in the river and come out and you'll be cleansed of your leprosy. And he just was too proud to do it. Didn't want to do it. But eventually he did. And he returns back to the man of God. He and his aides, and he came and stood before him, and he said, "Indeed, now I know that there's no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant." But he, in verse 16, that's Elisha, he said, "As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing." But he urges him. Naaman says, "Come on, take something." And Elisha refuses because Elisha realized he can't take a gift for this. This was he didn't have the ability to heal Naaman. You know, it wasn't his wisdom, really, it was all about what God had given him. And he realizes that you don't take and make benefits on these things that God reveals. You give God the credit. It was the God of Israel that healed you. And what he really wanted was for Naaman to be impressed at that and make a difference in his life. And I think in the end, he did. Naaman walks out of there a different person. So Naaman then says in verse 17, well, you know, look, if you won't do that, let me have those two mule loads of earth so that at least he can have sacrifices off of those mule loads of earth from Israel. And he was going to offer sacrifices to the Lord and so on. But then you get down to verse 19, all right? And so he said to him, go in peace. And he departed from him a short distance. So this is the way it starts out. But Gehazi has some other ideas in mind. So Gehazi, he's the servant of Elisha. He's around Elisha all the time. And really, when you look back and you think about Elisha, what do you think about Elisha? Did Elisha have a lot of stuff?
No.
No. Do you have all those gadgets and toys?
Really poor.
Probably really poor. He might not even have the buff body, right?
Sorry. Probably not.
Probably not, right? I don't know if he did any workouts. It doesn't seem like Elisha had a lot of those things. He basically had nothing of this life. And Gehazi is his servant, so he's going around with this guy all the time who basically has nothing except his faith in God. And Gehazi, he's one of these guys that's got other things in mind. He's got other dreams. So he decides, you know, and look at what he says in verse 20. As the Lord lives. Now, this is interesting to me because Gehazi is not a wicked person. He's one of us. He's a believer in God. You know, as Yahweh lives, he refers to the God of Israel. He brings God into the picture, and I'm going to go run after this guy and get something from him. So it's not like he's viewing this as though this is something independent from God. He thinks of himself as a good religious person worshiping God, the God of heaven, but he's still going to make some money off this other guy. He's trying to serve God and mammon. That's what he's really doing. So he runs him down in this case. He goes after him in verse 22, and he says to him, "Well, my master has sent me." So here's what happens when you serve mammon. What's wrong with verse 22? What does this lead to? Lies. Yeah, see what happens when you're trying to serve two masters? In order to justify what's going on, he's put in a predicament. Now he's got to lie. My master has sent me, saying, indeed, now just now two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments. So see how he works this out? He presents it as though, I don't really want this. This is going to be for somebody else. And this is the deception that goes on. So you have deception, lies, all this kind of stuff, because he's trying to serve God and mammon. This is what it leads to. And you make these compromises in life. And for each one of us, it's going to be something different. This was Gehazi's compromise, but the compromises that we make are probably along a different line. But it's the same kind of thing. It's deception and lies in order to get what we want. So he finally comes back to Elisha, and Elisha knows exactly what he's done. And again, you know, here come the lies. Where have you been, Gehazi? Oh, your servant didn't go anywhere. Well, of course he did. All right. And so because of all of this, you know, watch what happens. Consequences. This is what happens in our life. If God didn't care about you, what he would do in life when we make these kind of mistakes is he'd just bring some kind of punishment in your life and just write you off and you're gone. But that's not how he works. He brings chastening into your life. He brings something to remind you that, look it, you don't want to go down this pathway and ever do this again. And so, like in the case of Gehazi now, the leprosy of Naaman will cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. Now, that doesn't mean that God wrote him off. He didn't kick him out of the kingdom. But he did something in his life now. He brought a consequence into his life to try to prevent Gehazi from going down this pathway of trying to serve God and mammon. Now, this is what angels do. Like, you look at other Bible characters that have had weaknesses like this, because everybody does have some kind of weakness. Samson had a weakness for girls. We know that. He was a godly man, but he had a weakness for women. So, what did the angels finally do? They took it away. They took out his eyes. And we look at that, and you read through that story, and you just think, well, that was terrible. He had his eyes taken out. But that was how they saved him. This is what angels do. They bring things into our life. We may not like it, but the further down we go a pathway and the weaker we are, the stronger the medicine it takes to bring us out. And so this is how God treats his family members. He does do what he can to try to save us. But even then, Naaman could have walked away from this with the leprosy, and he's got to make a choice. Is the leprosy going to remind him about his mistake so that he learns from his mistake and doesn't do it again? Or is he just going to get angry at God? And that could be it. Just get mad. Then what makes the difference? How come some people get angry at God and some people end up saying, all right, I made a mistake. I'll live with this. Why is that the case? Why are people different like that? And I really think what happens, the difference is people that don't have a relationship with God, don't view them as a loving father, don't understand how tough it is for him to save us, get angry at God. They get mad because they don't understand the game plan. When you do realize how tough it is to save us, how bad we really are by nature, and how thankful you are that God is involved in your life, when he brings some tragedy into your life, you sit back and say, thanks. I know it's not happy. You're not happy about it. It's painful, like Paul says. It's a terrible time to go through. But you realize deep down, this is God's way of grabbing a hold of you, shaking you up, and saying, hey, we got to work on this. We got a problem here. And he's trying to like develop our character. So it's not because he hates us. It's because he loves us. And some people respond one way, and other people respond the other way. I've seen it in our CYCs and our ecclesias. I'm not talking about Christadelphian people sometimes respond both ways. Because if we don't have that trusting, faithful relationship with God, then our tendency is to then write it off as you get angry with God. You're just upset with him for what he's brought into our life. So as Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, that where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And it really reveals to us what we really want in life. And the angels do that every so often. They just bring things into your life so that you can look in the mirror and find out, what do you really want? Because it's really easy to deceive ourselves. Come to meeting every week on Sunday. Go to Bible class on Wednesday night or whenever you have it. Show up for CYC. Go to Sunday school. You go to all the stuff, and we've deceived ourselves because we're really not in it. Or we're in it for the wrong reason. And we're really not on the game plan that God's on. We're in it for a different reason. And so every so often, they have to wake us up and say, wait a minute, where really is your treasure? And they do that because they love us and they want us to join them in God's family. I thought another interesting one where the same kind of thing shows up, but a different case here. You got Ahab. You remember, this is another Sunday school story. You remember what happened with Ahab when he wanted Naboth's vineyard. So 1 Kings 21, first five verses there. It came to pass that Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard which was in Jezreel, and he spoke. It was right next to the palace of Ahab. And so Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, "Give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a vegetable garden." Right? And because it's near, next to my house, and I'll give you a vineyard better than it. Or if it seems good to you, I'll give you its worth in money. So it's not like he just wanted to take it. He says, look, I'll give you something even better than that. Different place, or I'll give you some money for it. All right, this is what he did. But Naboth realizes that the way God had set up the land of Israel was all by inheritance through the family. This was all part of what God had wanted, that things stayed within the family, you passed them down through the family line, that it was that God really stressed this concept of inheritance, because he was trying to deal with the fact that not only were you passing on land, but you were going to pass on godly characteristics. Teach your children about God. So he says, I'm not going to do that. Ahab goes in his house all sullen and displeased because of the word that Naboth had spoken to him. And he lays down in his bed, and you can imagine him pouting. This is the king of Israel, and he's pouting away on his bed like a little baby, crying away, and Jezebel comes in. You're like, oh dear, what's the matter with you today? What do you need? And of course, she's got a plan. You know, Ahab doesn't come up with the plan. She does, and maybe he just like got used to that. And you know what happened, you know, because Ahab, basically, he got whatever he wanted. But there's the problem. You can't really serve two masters. Ahab was trying to serve God officially. He was the king of Israel, and of course, he went through all the religious ceremonies, and he tried to pretend that way, that he was religious. But at the same time, you know, here he is married to Jezebel, and, you know, she's leading him down a whole other pathway. And Ahab really liked that pathway. That's where he would choose to go. And to serve his covetousness in the end, Ahab really had to throw his Bible away. That's basically what happens. So God brings these events into our life to help us make a choice. Which one do you really want? And God's trying to find that out too. He's trying to figure out, like, where are you really at in life? And he wants us to know where we're at as well. And in this case, you could just see where Ahab could look back over the things that he did and all the stuff he did to get Naboth's vineyard and realize that, wow, he made some pretty nasty choices because he cared so much about that vineyard. Now, in Mark chapter 7, this issue of covetousness. Covetousness in the Bible comes up a lot, where we end up wanting something and serving the god mammon instead of serving the Lord our God. And you remember what Jesus did when he called the disciples to him in Mark 7. Pick it up around verse 17 there. When he'd entered a house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him about his saying up there at the top, that it's nothing that enters a man from the outside that defiles him, but the things that come out of him. Those are the things that defile a man. So you could see, like, from the Jewish perspective, they had been trained, it was all about what you eat. Be careful what you eat. Don't eat pork. Don't eat all those unclean things. Don't eat all this stuff. And they were so into the legal law of what you don't eat, they never saw beyond the law. Because they thought God cared about what they ate. He didn't really care about what they ate. He wanted them to learn from that there's a difference between what you put into your mind, not so much your body, and what you put into your mind will make a difference in your life. He wanted them to grow spiritually. So Jesus finally says to them in plain language in verse 18, he said to them, "Are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from the outside cannot defile him, because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods?" That's pretty good biology, isn't it? He understood what a lot of people don't understand today, that what goes into your mouth goes into your stomach, goes right on through and out. And it really never is in your body, is it? Technically, not really in you, because it goes right on through and it's out. But on the other hand, you know, what comes out of a man, that defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within and defile a man. And I think if we're honest, that somewhere up in that list, you can find out we're all up there somewhere. That's where we all start in life. Everybody has some of those characteristics. Fortunately, I don't know if we got all of them in a super dose. Otherwise, we'd really get discouraged in life. But God's given everybody some of those things to work on. We've all got our own personal list. And thankfully, the angels know us inside out, and they know exactly which ones they have to work on. But that is the problem. It all comes from within. And what God's done for us in the textbook that we've got, in the book for playing the game His way, He's basically given us a procedure that will help to eliminate those things, if you really want to get rid of them. If you're the kind of person, for example, that's really into, like, you know, something that's defiling you, like you're into like some kind of deceit. You're one of those people that loves to like scheme through life by deceiving other people, and you think, oh, I'm so clever, I fooled them, I got away with this, and you pull off this thing. What God will do is He'll train you through life, if you let Him. He'll bring things into your life that help you realize this is not an effective way to work with people. This is not good. And you'll find out by either your job, it could be at your job, it could be in your family, it could be your ecclesia, but somewhere He will train us to realize that's not really the kind of person we want to be. And so eventually He'll try to work those things right out of our life and get rid of pride and foolishness and all those different things. That's what He's out to do. So when you look at covetousness in particular, covetousness involves, you know, as a concept, you want something more than what God has given you. I mean, it really boils down to it. So God's given you a piece of something in life. He's given you like a popsicle up there. But you look around and you realize, wow, yeah, Glenn doesn't have a popsicle. He's got a little ice cream there. And you look around at other people and it's like, oh yeah, look at that. You got a little coupon there to go out to somewhere else and get something even better. And you start looking around. This is what we do. You start looking around. What does everybody else have? You ever notice that? I used to see that in school all the time when I would hand out things. First thing a lot of kids would do is look around at what did everybody else get on the test, you know, because that way they could like try to figure out where they were at. Or when they would hand out things and it would be like a special day at school and you'd hand out some kind of prizes or something like that, people would like look around, what did you get? Probably some of you just did that recently at the gift day on December 25, and you start looking around and what did everybody else get? You know, and really we should be happy and satisfied and thankful for what God has given us. That's what we should be. But the natural tendency is that we want to look around at what everybody else got, and we just become unthankful, unhappy people. And it really doesn't matter how much you get in life. I've been amazed at you look at situations in life where people are brought from like one form of work, and I've seen them brought to a different form of work where the employer gave them all the things they could have ever imagined that they would have never had back at their previous job. And he gives them housing, He gives them cars, he gives them all this stuff that they could have never even imagined having in their previous job, and He gives them all this stuff, and for the first 2 or 3 months, they're really thankful. And then they start looking around at, well, what do you have? What else did you get that wasn't on my list? And it only takes like 3 to 4 months before those same people that were so thankful are now unhappy, unthankful, because they've realized, oh, you got something I didn't get. Oh, and what did you get? You got that? It's like, whoa, I didn't get that. And then they want an upgrade. I mean, you look at like sports characters, they do this all the time. Somebody gets a contract and they land some great contract where they're paid so many millions of dollars, and you think like, how can they not be satisfied with that? Well, and then next year, some other guy gets one, they get paid even more. And then they start looking, I want to renegotiate my contract. It's like, this is the human way. We are covetous by nature. That's the way we are as people. And so what the angels have to do, what God's working on, is to train us in faith to believe that God has given us everything we need. So you don't have to, with eyes, start looking around at what everybody else has in life and say, well, I want some of that, and I want some of that, because I won't be happy until I get, oh, what they've got over there. And that's really what happens in life. Well, you can see that with the desserts that were out today. I saw somebody come back to get desserts at lunchtime. And he got back there to get his dessert and realized, wow, other people had this thing. And he gets back there, they're all gone. And it's like, he really wanted that thing, and it was all gone. It's like frustrating. It's like, wow, they all got one and I didn't. And this is what happens in life. We're like this. And so you have to, again, respond one of two ways. When other people get things in life that you don't get, you can either thank God for what you have and be happy for the other people that they were able to get those things, and actually tell them, oh, that's great you got that. Oh, that's fantastic. You got that too? That's good. Or we can get angry and upset, see that the cup is only half full, and we can even get angry at God, like, why didn't you get me this? Or we start scheming in life so that we can have that stuff too. And this is what human people do. Anyways, it turns us, in the end, I really believe, because I've watched this happen with so many people that were given so much, in the end they become selfish, unthankful, and unhappy people because they're always wanting what everybody else has. Now, I used to watch this in school when I was teaching school, and some student would walk in after Christmas or after their birthday or something, and they'd walk in and they would flash in front of everybody, you know, I just got an iPhone 6, yeah, look at that. And then the other kids would look around, and I'd hear people make these comments like, well, my parents didn't get me one. You know, and I'd look at them like, what? You know, it's my parents didn't get me one? It's like, why in the world throw that back on your parents? Like, is every parent supposed to buy an iPhone 6 for their kid? I didn't get any for my kids. But that was the thinking that was going on in teenagers' minds. It's like, my mom and dad didn't get me that. You know, just because your dad gave you one of those, that means your dad's supposed to give you one of those too? This is how people think. This is covetousness at its worst. And in the end, we get mad at people because they didn't get us this. We get mad at God because he hasn't given us what we want. And it becomes a very frustrating life. You'll see this at times with women that get married and they're, you know, they're looking around and everybody else is having children and they're not. And you watch that in the Bible, how women got frustrated. Look at what it did to Rachel. It drove her crazy that Leah was having children. And it's a very frustrating thing. People have something that God hasn't given me. And so, look, we want to go home realizing we want to be thankful for what God has given us. We want to be happy people. We want to be content with what God has given us. Let's not go home as covetous people, always wanting the latest, greatest thing that's out and unhappy and unthankful for what we have. I mean, this is what other people of the world would look at, and they'd call this is a first world problem, right? First world problem. You won't find people in Africa worrying about whether they got a popsicle or an ice cream cone. That's a first world problem. Or whether you got an iPhone 6 or I just got a Samsung Galaxy instead. You know, these are first world problems. But honestly, young people, we can make big issues out of stuff like this, and it's unimportant stuff. It's all about the stuff of life, not about what really matters. This is what Solomon finally came to understand, is forget about the small stuff. So in Colossians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul, in writing to these Colossians that we were looking at this morning, remember he reminded them that when you put to death your members which are on earth, it's fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. And he points out to them that, yeah, you used to be like this, but when you were baptized, you died. You died to sin. You no longer serve sin as your master. And instead, you walk out of the waters of baptism with your sins forgiven, but committed to serve the Lord your God, to serve our Lord Jesus Christ. That's what we do. And what God expects then is that if we trust him and we are confident that he's giving us everything we need, that and then we won't be one of these covetous people. I used to find in teaching high school, this was a really big topic between kids in terms of high school students, a lot of teenagers, because they're looking around all the time trying to figure out what everybody else had in life, or they're comparing notes about, well, what you have in your family versus mine, and how your parents treat you versus how mine treat me. And all the time I used to hear people use the phrase, that's not fair. That was the common thing that I would hear all the time. That's not fair. That's not fair. And if we're not careful, young people, we end up throwing that right back at God. Like, that's not fair that I got this and they got that. And God's wanting us to trust him. You don't get the same thing everybody else got. You really don't. You know, I remember there was one day when there was an autistic child coming into my classroom. And they warned me. They thought I would work out well with them because I have an autistic child in my house. So they brought this boy in. They told me he's going to be in your biology class. Biology? And this guy is autistic. And it's like, how's this going to work? You know, I wondered what he would do on lab days. And is he going to like wreck the equipment? Is he going to throw stuff? Is he going to hurt people? Whatever. Anyways, I told the kids the day before he came, I told everybody in the class. I said, look, this fellow's coming in. He's going to be different than all of you. And I'm going to treat him differently than all of you. But just because I do, don't think that you can get away with what he gets away with, because he needs this. He needs greater flexibility. He's dealing with issues you don't have to deal with. And this is exactly what the angels do with us all the time. They give us what we need. They don't treat us equal. And I found out it was a common concept amongst teenagers that everybody wanted to be treated equal. Maybe that's the human, the American way, that all men were created equal. Right? It's right in our Constitution. That's the biggest joke in the world. We were not created equal. Everybody here got a different set of genes. You were never equal to start with. And you don't get treated equal by God. We all get given the gift of grace. But to get there in the end and to join his family, he has to treat everybody with custom-made events to help you develop into his family. And what I need and what you need and what he needs and she needs, we all need different things. And that's what our God does. He doesn't treat us all equal. And thank God he doesn't. Or probably most of us would never make it. We need something that works for me. So I don't know whether you've ever noticed, but when you go back and look at the Ten Commandments, did you realize that covetousness was in the top 10? Which one is it? 10, right? And when he points out covetousness, I don't know if you ever look at the commandment, but it isn't just that you shall not covet anything belongs to your neighbor. He starts out, you shall not covet this, you shall not covet that, you won't cover your neighbor's wife, you won't cover his stuff, you won't cover this, and in the end, don't covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. And it's just a basic overall, like, cover it all kind of thing, because this is a common problem that people have. And God realized that it was going to ruin your life, and he wasn't going to be able to save you if you were always trying to figure out why I can't have more. So what he's hoping is that when we turn to him and we serve God rather than mammon, that in the end we won't get locked up into these things where we're bowing down and doing everything for our cars and we're like worshiping money as, you know, we just give our life to money. This is what can happen when you start thinking money's going to make you happy. And so you go out and you work and work and work to get some job where you make lots of money, only to find out in the end that that money really can't buy you into the kingdom of God. And it wasn't really buy most people happiness. I remember they did a study back probably 10 years ago now, and some people were really surprised. They were psychologist people, and they were trying to figure out the connection between money and happiness and what really made people happy with money. And much to their surprise that they didn't understand at all was that people were made the happiest with money when they gave the money away. And that was something that blew the minds of the psychologists doing the study. They didn't realize that actually giving what you have to other people brings greater happiness than just using it yourself. Now, I think a lot of parents knew that because they constantly give away their money to their kids all the time. Some of them get those iPhone 6s. Others of them buy you clothes. They buy you food every day. They give you a place to live. They pay for your electricity. They get you your gas to go to the gathering. Probably some of your parents paid for your gathering here today, didn't they? Yeah, I'll bet they did. See, they're constantly putting out stuff on you, right? Because they realize that's really what will bring them happiness in the end. They can have no greater joy than to hear that their children walk in the truth. So, covetous people, right? Ephesians 5, when the Apostle Paul brings it up to the Ephesians, look at what he links it with. In verse 3, fornication, all uncleannesses or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for the saints, neither filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather, here's the opposite. So here's what you do if you're not covetous. You learn to be content, and you give thanks. This is really true in life. You can look around at people that are covetous, and you'll find they're really not happy. They're not thankful people, because they're always wanting more. On the other hand, people that are content, they're not covetous of what everybody else has, many of them can become happy people. It doesn't always make them that. But I used to find in high school, this is a really common link. The people that weren't hung up in covetousness, they ended up being happier people. And the ones that were definitely unhappy. They always saw the cup half full in life. Half empty, rather. They never saw it as half full. They always looked at the negative side. So he says there that you know that no fornicator, unclean person, or covetous man who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words. See, covetous people won't be in God's kingdom because Jesus said you cannot serve God and mammon. You can't do both. You get one or the other. But don't be deceived. Don't try to fool yourself into thinking that God's going to tolerate us as covetous people. Now, look at the case of Balaam. Remember the story of Balaam? What was Balaam supposed to do? He got hired by Balak. What was he supposed to do? He's a prophet. What did Balak want him to do? Curse Israel. He wanted to bring this prophet out here. He says, look, we'll find the best place for you to stand. We'll offer all the sacrifices you want. We'll do all the religious stuff you're supposed to do. But you're a prophet. What I want you to do is get up there and look at those Jews down there in the valley, and I want you to curse them. Bring down the curses of God on those people, and I'll pay you lots of money. That was the offer. So what happened when Balaam went out there to curse them? Every time he went to curse them, what happened? God gave him words to say that blessed the Jews rather than cursing them. Right? And you read through the story, and so we try a new spot. He goes around to different spots, tries the same thing every time. It's a blessing on Israel, never a curse. And the story sort of gets left there hanging. And if you don't read through the rest of your Bible, you don't even realize what was going on. But, you know, in this case here, when Balaam was going out to curse the people at this point, he was told, you know, if they don't come to get you, don't go with them. But he got up and he went anyways. He gets on his donkey, right, and he starts walking out there. And his donkey sees the angel of the Lord standing there, and Balaam doesn't see him. But really, God tried to stop him. He tried to prevent him from going down this pathway. But Balaam wanted the money. He was given to covetousness. He really wanted to make the money off of it. And so in the end, he finds a way to bring down cursing on the children of Israel. What did he do? Remember what his strategy was in the end? How did he do it? He couldn't do it by giving a prophecy of cursing them. So what did he do? This is where you got to put a few pieces together in the Bible. He found out how to get the Jews' own God angry at them. How did he pull that off? Remember? He couldn't give a curse against them. So he said to Balak, he said, here's what you do. Get all your pretty teenage girls and have them go down to the Jewish camp. Yeah. And get the Jewish boys to take them and get them involved in the idolatry and the immorality of your community, and their own God will hate them and he'll curse them. And did it work? It did. And he's forever remembered for that. You see, but this was Balaam's counsel. He knew he couldn't curse them himself. He couldn't give a prophecy of cursing, so he comes up with this other strategy. So you find, like in Numbers 22, when the people came down there, they took with them to talk to Balaam. It says there he took with them the fee for divination. And Balaam knew they had this money in their pockets ready to give him. He wanted that money so bad, he kept working away at finding a strategy that he could bring curses down on the Jewish people, even though he couldn't give a prophecy because God kept putting words into his mouth that blessed the people. So he comes up with this other strategy about, well, get them involved in immorality, and then their own God will curse them. So he does. So you find it when Jude is writing, and Jude is writing about people that had slipped into ecclesial life where they have the wrong motives about what they were doing. And in Jude verse 4, certain men whose condemnation was written about long ago have slipped in among you. They're godless men who changed the grace of our God into a license for immorality and denied Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. So what was happening in Jude's day is that people had taken the Apostle Paul's gift of grace, the freedom that we have in Christ to be away from the law, and they had taken it so far that they said, hey, let's sin that grace may abound. We can become immoral. We can do whatever we want, and then God will just pile on more grace and more grace. So that's what Jude says. They changed the grace of God into a license for immorality. That was their strategy. This is what some of those people would do that misunderstood Paul's writings. So woe to them. They've taken the way of Cain, and they've rushed for profit into Balaam's error. See what happened, how he links up the immorality that was there with the rush for profit into Balaam's error, and they've been destroyed in Korah's rebellion. These were people in ecclesial life. These weren't outsiders from the world. These weren't people at school that, you know, never came to meeting. These were people that came to the ecclesia that were acting like this. These are blemishes at your love feast and eating with you without the slightest qualm. Shepherds who feed only themselves. So the warning that's out there to us young people is that this kind of a philosophy easily can creep into your life. It comes in from the people of this world, and it slips in amongst religious people, and it can easily creep into us, where we start focusing in on all this other stuff that other people have that we don't get. We try to somehow justify it and bring it into our life in Christ, but you cannot serve God and mammon. And so the Apostle Paul writes to Timothy, trying to encourage Timothy that, look, at the a love of money is a root of all evil. Don't get hung up in this, Timothy. And he tries to encourage him that godliness with contentment is great gain. And I really believe that is one of the secrets of life that the Apostle Paul had learned, is this is how you overcome this covetous feeling. You learn to be content with what you have. I used to watch teenagers at school that were very content. They were happy kids. They would come in every day, oh, how are you, Mr. Stiles? And they would talk to me, tell me about how great their life was, things that were happening in their life. And some of them had very little. They weren't the ones walking around with the iPhones. Oh, no, these were just people that appreciated what they had. They were content with what they had. And they came in as very happy, very thankful, and very nice kids to be with. And this is what it will do for us. When you learn to be content with what God has given you in your life, you will come out of it a much happier and thankful person than when you're always wishing about and wanting for things that you really don't have. It really does produce contentment. I find that the Apostle Paul, I think that's when you look at some of the modern versions in Philippians chapter 4, when he's talking about all the important things of life, he says it in verse 11 there, "For I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances." Isn't that amazing that Paul could do that? When you look at the things that he went through, shipwreck, beaten, left for dead, stoned, all those things that happened to him. How did he keep such a positive attitude? Well, he learned to be content whatever the circumstances. You know, as you go through this, you find out he calls this a secret. This is a secret not everybody understands. But if you do, you're going to become a much happier and thankful person. He says, "I know what it is to be in need. And I know what it is to have plenty. I've been in both circumstances. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through Him, through Christ, who strengthens me." And that was the secret the Apostle Paul had learned. Really, godliness with contentment is great gain. You will be much happier people, much more fun to be around. Your relationships with other people will just grow, and your relationship with God will grow amazingly when we learn to be content with whatever God has given us. So you guys have lots of choices ahead. You know, you leave here this weekend, you go back home, most of you to some kind of school, some of you maybe to jobs, but you know, you got to make some big choices over the next few years if Christ stays away. Where are you going to live? Are you going to get married? Who are you going to marry? You're going to go into the mission field. What kind of a career are you going to take? Right? You have to make all these decisions. Are you going to go to university? Are you just going to get a job somewhere? These are all choices that all of you guys have ahead of you in the next years to come. So the key is to pray about it and ask for God's help, that He will help you make godly decisions. Because you're going to have to make choices one way or the other. You can't just keep going through life and putting it off. I mean, some of you do that, living at home and going to school. You just figure, well, what are you going to do next year? Well, I'm just going to go to school again and live at home. I used to ask some kids that in high school. They were in 11th grade. What are you going to do? You know, you're thinking about the future, and it's like, oh, I'm just going to keep living at home and go to school. Because that way they didn't have to make any choices. They kept putting it off. But God does expect us at some point to make choices, and He wants us to choose. And He's hoping that we will make a godly choice. So in your tough decisions that you have in front of you, let's make sure that in these days right now, that you go home and read as much as you can about the Bible. Get it in your head. Get it in there so that you can draw on that later on when you go to make those choices. You want to make choices that are based upon godly things, godly principles. And the only way to do that is to have the Bible in your mind. So when you're young right now and your brains are like sponges, soak up the stories and try to analyze what made people tick. How did they make good choices in life? And try to get those things in your head. And don't forget, faith is the key. You want to do everything you possibly can to keep growing in faith. So whatever choices that you make, make sure this is part of it. That your goal is to grow in faith. So if you go to college or if you don't, if you get married or if you don't, whatever that choice is, you want it to increase your faith. That's what you're really after, whichever way you go. And remember, the goal in the end is, although God says it's your choice, He's not going to make the choice for you. What we want to try to do is make our choice the one that God would choose. We want to make these two merge together. You know, choose something that's in the pathway that God would like so that we can be walking in a pathway that leads to His kingdom. And that's what we really want to do. So we got this war going on in our head. We really do. All of us know what it is. You wake up with it every morning. It's the spirit versus the flesh. Paul calls it a war in Romans chapter 7. He refers to it that way. And so if you're going to win the war, if you're going to let God win the war, you've got to get as much of God into your head as possible. Get it into your mind, whatever that is. If that's reading your Bible, then you do that. If it's like listening to somebody read, then do that. Whatever works for you as an individual, I really think you have to find out what works for you and really go that route, because it's not the same for every person. For some of you, it's reading the text. Other people, God's given us great electronic gadgets today where you can put the Bible on and tapes and listen to classes and put them on little machines you can carry in your hand or clip on your shirt. And you can listen to all kinds of good stuff to try to help us make good choices. You know, He's given us all those different options. We've got visual aids today that you can get on. You can find all kinds of things. And that's great. That's good about our technology age. But make sure you tap into some of those things and take advantage of them. If you're tired and you don't feel like reading the Bible, then, you know, get on BibleGateway.com or something and just like listen to, you know, some of those guys read it to you. You can listen to it in all different ways. You can either have just a standard straight way of reading the Bible, or you can have music playing in the background. Or if you're one of those people that likes to dramatize ones where some guy says something and somebody else comes in and responds and they put different voices in, whatever it works for you, do it. But be glad God has given us all these options today of things that we can get into our head to overcome these natural things that are in our mind. You know, because we really got to think about, when you leave the camp this week, who are you going home to serve? Who are you really setting out to serve next week? Are all your choices based on promoting yourself and what you want and all these things that you think are going to bring you happiness? Or are you doing things that are somehow going to enhance your faith, your spiritual life, so that God will want you and His family? And hopefully we'll learn to make the same choice that Joshua suggested. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That was Joshua's claim to the whole community at that time. And don't forget, where your treasure is, that's where your heart really is. And God's going to help you understand that. Right? And in the end, God may give you what you really want. If you really want this stuff of this world, you may get it for a while, and then it'll all be gone. But if you really want to be in His family, He promises He'll help you get there. So let's make sure then that we choose good things. Let's, we're going to choose God and not choose to serve mammon. You can't serve them both. God will help you if you choose to serve Him. He doesn't leave you on your own. And pray for God's help with tough choices. Don't be afraid to ask God to give you direction and help you understand which way you should go, because He loves you and He wants what's best for you to bring you into His family. And He knows where your treasure is, but He might have to help you see it. And don't forget, Paul's secret of life is to learn to be content with what you have. Learn to be content and trust that God, our loving Father in heaven, He's given us everything that we need, but it may not be the same thing as what He gives our brothers and sisters, our friends, our other family members, because He knows what we need and He gives us what we need.